Ezra chapter 9. This is a really good chapter. I enjoyed studying through this, and I hope there's some things here that can be of help to us. You know, as I finished the message and I was thinking about all that we're going to be sharing here tonight, the thought crossed my mind that it ought to be mandatory for every young person, before he or she finds and chooses a sweetheart, have a good long talk with a Christian who is married to an unbeliever. And let that person tell them of the disagreements and the pain and the heartaches and the grief of such a marriage brings. I've talked to a lot of different Christians over the years who were in that situation. It's not a happy picture. It's a very painful picture. And God warns us about this, and He warns us both in the Old Testament, as we'll see tonight, and it's also warned us of it in the New Testament, and we're going to note that as well tonight. The importance of choosing a spouse who is a believer. Now, some Christians are married to an unbeliever because they came to Christ after they were married. Can't do anything about that. Can't really do anything about the fact whether you made a mistake and married an unbeliever either. But nonetheless, it wasn't something that they walked into. But marriage to an unbeliever is a mixed marriage. It's a marriage between a believer and an unbeliever, and thus it is a mixed marriage. Okay, and we're going to be looking at that this evening. You know, I want each of us to pay close attention to this, because here in Ezra chapter 9, God gives us a description of a very serious sin that took place in Israel in the area of their marriages. And Ezra, when he found out about it, was horrified and terrified, really. And he gives us some information here that is very timely for us today, especially for our young people. So as we look at this, first of all, I want us to notice Ezra's first identification of the crime. What was the crime he was going to address here? We see in verse number 1, chapter 9 of Ezra. Now when these things were done, the princes came to me saying, "The people of Israel and the princes and the Levites have not separated themselves from the people of the lands according to their abominations. Even the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Jebusites and the Amorites and the Moabites and the Egyptians and the Amorites. For they have taken of their daughters for themselves and for their sons, so that the holy seed have mingled themselves with the people of those lands. Yea, the hand of the princes and rulers hath been chief in this trespass." So Ezra identifies for us, first of all, the crime that had taken place. They had failed to separate themselves from the people of the lands. Now remember, Ezra had just arrived. Chapter 8 is when Ezra arrived. He arrives here in Jerusalem, and he just barely gets settled and just gets over the fatigue of the travel, and the people come to him, the rulers that were godly, and said, "We've got a problem here and you need to know about it." Now, a lot of the men and women of in our people have not separated themselves from the people of the lands. In fact, they have gone ahead and they have chosen for themselves and for their sons wives of the people of the land. Now, was God against this because the people, the girls in the land were not pretty? You think that was the case, Levi? No, I don't think so either. It wasn't because they were nice looking. It wasn't because they were, you know, they weren't maybe nice people. You can have unbelievers that are fairly nice people. I've known several over the years that were very nice people. But the problem was is that they didn't know God. And because they didn't know God, they were worshiping false gods and they were following false ways, and it was going to lead the people of Israel the wrong direction. The nations that are listed here, all the pagan nations around Israel. Look at that list here. You've got the Canaanites. They were the main ones in the central part of the land. The Hittites and the Perizzites and the Jebusites were all part of that main people of the land. The Amorites were on the northeast, and the Moabites were on the southeast, and the Egyptians were on the south. The Amorites were on the south. They're all around the nations were these other pagan nations, and they had chosen wives for themselves and for their children from amongst these people. And he says there that the holy seed had mingled themselves with the people of the lands. This holy seed he's talking about is God's people. They had returned to the land 80 years earlier. And so for 80 years they have been mingling with the people of the land. And there's a great temptation because, you know, your farm is right next door to the farm of an Amorite, and they're such nice people, and they got a nice, beautiful young daughter here, and she's just your age, and she looks like she'd probably be all right. They're nice people. Yeah, they don't worship our God, but they're nice people. And they started justifying and making excuses, and little by little they became friends with them, and little by little they began to make marriages with them and intermarried with these unbelieving nations. Now we ask ourselves an important question. Why was that a sin? Why was that a sin? Well, first of all, we find that it was a sin because it was against God's command. Yeah, look down with me in verses 11 and 12. He goes into a little bit more detail here. I'm jumping ahead. He's ushering a prayer off to God. And in his prayer, he quotes some of the command of God in verse number 11, which thou hast commanded by the servants of the prophets, saying, the land unto which ye go to possess it is an unclean land, with the filthiness of the people of the lands, with their abominations, and which have filled it from one end to the other with uncleanness. Now, therefore, give not your daughters unto their sons, neither take their daughters unto your sons, nor seek their peace or their wealth forever, that ye may be strong and eat the good of the land and leave it for an inheritance to your children forever. Now, Ezra is quoting or paraphrasing the command of God that he had given years and years and years ago. When was that? That was way back before Joshua's day. Back in Moses' day. And Moses passed it on to Joshua. And Joshua led the people into the land. And he says, don't forget, when you conquer the land, don't marry with the children of the people of the land. Don't do that. You've got to wipe them out. And God, remember, I find it very interesting. God told Abraham, what did God tell Abraham about the land? He said, it's going to be your land someday, but it won't be for another 400 years because the people of the land are not yet, what? As wicked as they would be. And I'm paraphrasing that. God says, I cannot justify wiping them out right now because they're not as vile as they're going to be. But one day they will be so filthy and so vile and so perverted and so wicked that they cannot exist any longer. And God said, I will be justified then in wiping them out. And so he told Joshua, when you go into the land, you are to take and wipe them out completely. Not to allow any to live. You know, we look at that today as genocide type of thing. We think that's terrible. You should do that. But God had a perfect right to do that because God saw their hearts. God saw what was taking place in them. And God knew that if he didn't wipe them out, what would happen? They would intermingle with his people and intermarry with his people and pervert his people and corrupt his people, and they would fall away from God. And did that happen? It did. You read the book of Judges. What a sad story in the book of Judges. Page after page in the book of Judges, it says they conquered the city, but they couldn't drive out these people, and they live amongst them until this day. And the next one, they conquered this city, but they couldn't drive out the people, so they live amongst them until this day. And on through the book of Judges. And then the end of Judges says, and the people did what was right in their own eyes because there was no king in the land. They just did what they wanted to do. And they had forgotten God. They had neglected God. Why did that happen? Because they had intermingled with the people of the land. And eventually, it got so bad that in the northern kingdom, they were so perverted, so vile. In fact, I just read yesterday or the day before that Ahab the king married Jezebel. Jezebel, who was she? She was the daughter of the king of Zidon. Up in the north, Tyre and Sidon. And she was a worshiper of Baal. And by marrying her, he pulled Baal in worship into the land. And it corrupted the land more so. And it got more and more vile. The northern kingdom, the 10 tribes of the northern kingdom, eventually, off to captivity. And they've never been returned. They've spread all over the world. They're gone. Oh, yes, there's Jews out there and there's Jewish blood out there. God knows where they all are. But what I'm saying is they've never come back to the land. And then the southern kingdom, God had Isaiah and Jeremiah tell him, don't follow your older sisters up there and follow that way. You've got to stop marrying with these people. You've got to stop worshiping their false gods. You've got to stop doing these things or you're going to go into captivity into Babylon. Went in one ear and out the other. They didn't listen. God sent them off to Babylon for 70 years. They've been in Babylon, they learned their lesson, they were punished in Babylon, they lost their nation, the temple was destroyed, their homes were destroyed, everything was wiped out, and now, 70 years later, they came back, and they've been in the land for 80 years. And they're back doing the same thing again. And Ezra says, what are you doing? That's exactly what your ancestors did that ended them up in Babylon. We just got back from Babylon. And you're doing the same thing again. And we're going to see as he goes on this, he's going to just describe that as he's praying about this even more. He's very, very concerned about that. Back in Deuteronomy chapter 7, let me read a few of the verses that deal with the sin that they were committing here. Deuteronomy chapter 7, and look with me at verses 1 to 4. Deuteronomy 7, verses 1 to 4. When the Lord thy God shall bring thee into the land whither thou goest to possess it, thou hast cast out many nations before thee, the Hittites and the Girgashites and the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites and the seven nations greater and mightier than thou. When the Lord thy God shall deliver them before thee, thou shalt smite them and utterly destroy them and shalt make no covenant with them nor show mercy unto them, neither shall you make any marriages with them. Thy daughters shall not give unto thy daughters shall thou not give unto his sons, nor his daughter take thou unto thy son, for they will turn away thy sons from following me, that they may serve other gods. So will the anger of the Lord be kindled against you and destroy you suddenly. Now Moses is writing this to the people just before he dies, just before Joshua takes over, and he's warning them, don't intermarry with the people of the land. You cannot do that. It'll destroy you. We see the same thing in the book of Judges, chapter 3, verse 6. We see it again in 1 Kings, chapter 11. This is another result of this. This is a sad, sad situation. 1 Kings, chapter 11. 1 Kings, chapter 11. 1 Kings chapter 11 and verse number 4. It says, for it came to pass, when Solomon was old, that his wives turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not perfect with the Lord his God, as was the heart of David his father. For Solomon went after Ashtaroth, the goddess of the Zidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. And Solomon did evil in the sight of the Lord, and went not fully after the Lord as David his father. Then did Solomon build high places to Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, and in the hill that was before Jerusalem, and for Molech, the abomination of the Ammonites. And likewise did he for all his strange wives, which burned incense and sacrificed unto their gods. And the Lord was angry with Solomon. Sad. I mean, Solomon, the wisest man, other than Jesus Christ, that has ever lived. He was brilliantly wise, but He was the wisest fool that ever lived. He knew what he was supposed to do, but he didn't do it. Now, you know, that's something important for us. You young people need to take good heed to this, and all of us really. But listen, you may be wise, you may know the Bible, you know, may know what is right. It's not a matter of what we know, it's a matter of what we do. And see, these people knew that God said, don't do it, but they did it anyway. Because they didn't care. And they fell away from God, and it got them into major trouble. You know, the lack of separation and intermarriage were primary causes of that Babylonian captivity. We see this down in verse number 7 of our text, Ezra 9, verse 7. Since the days of your fathers, which have been in great distress unto this day, and for your iniquities have we, our kings and our priests, been delivered into the hand of the kings of the lands to the sword and to the captivity and to the spoil and to confusion of face as it is this day. He says, we got what we deserved because we didn't obey God. We went into captivity. We lost everything. It was disastrous. And history revealed that the lack of that separation and intermarriage with the unbelievers ruined their morals and ruined their spiritual life. And you know, that is so true for us today. If we don't take heed to this and separate from the ungodly that are around us, it will ruin us. God tells us this clearly. Remember 1 Corinthians 15:33 says that evil communication corrupts good manners. You have bad friends, they're going to pollute you. It will happen. And God tells us again and again in the Word, He's warning us. Now the separation among God's people is still needed. And the Holy Spirit led the Apostle Paul to instruct Christians regarding separation and intermarriage. Let's turn over now to 2 Corinthians chapter 6. I want you to see this. Let's turn with me there. 2 Corinthians chapter 6. Very important passage. 2 Corinthians chapter 6. 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and notice with me, beginning with verse number 14. Be ye not unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what fellowship has righteousness with unrighteousness, and what communion has light with darkness? Now, let's stop for a moment. We're not a farming community, and yokes are not common in farming communities anymore anyway. But a yoke was a big collar, usually made out of wood, occasionally made out of iron, but it was a big collar that was spread across the necks of two oxen or two donkeys or two animals and fastened their neck together. So those two were locked together so that they had to do work together. They would use them for pulling plows, pulling wagons, and we've seen pictures of that. All right, so that was a yoke. And he said, do not be yoked together with an unbeliever. Now the strongest yoke known to the human race is marriage. And God here says, be not unequally yoked together with unbelievers. He goes on in verse 15, what concord hath Christ with Belial? That's the devil. Or what part hath he with believeth with an infidel? One that says, I don't believe a thing. And what agreement hath the temple of God with idols? For ye are the temple of the living God. As God has said, I will dwell with them and walk in them and be their God, and they shall be my people. Wherefore, come out from among them and be ye separate, saith the Lord, and touch not the unclean thing, and I will receive you and will be a father unto you. And ye shall be my sons and daughters, saith the Lord God, Lord Almighty. Having therefore these promises, dearly beloved, let us cleanse ourselves from all filthiness of the flesh and spirit, perfecting holiness in the fear of God. Now, what is he telling us here? He's given us some strict warnings about marrying unbelievers and being in bondage, or in a bond of unity with an unbeliever. You know, Amos said, can two walk together except they be agreed? They can't. And so it is that he's dealing with that here, and he's warning us and strongly urging us to take heed to this. Now, living with a partner outside of marriage is a yoke. Living with a partner outside of marriage yoke is not the answer. You know, a lot of people in our world say, well, yeah, forget marriage then. We don't need marriage. Just live together. And you know, it's unbelievable how that is spread in our world, even in our lifetimes. I just saw some statistics and it weren't exactly related to this, but it said that in America, about 20 years ago, and I don't have the, I didn't have it written down here, I'm just remembering what I saw. About 20 or maybe 30 years ago, there was like 43% of the homes in America had mom and dad married and living with their kids. About 20 years later, it was down to 23%. And the last they surveyed, it was down to 17%. 17% of the families have mom and dad married and living together with kids. Tragic. It's tragic. And we're seeing that spread all over. God very clearly tells us, Hebrews 13:4, marriage is honorable and all in the bed undefiled, but whoremongers and adulterers God will judge. God says it's wrong to live outside of marriage in a marriage type of a relationship without being married. God says that's wrong. Now, Paul tells us here in 2 Corinthians chapter 6, the believers and unbelievers have nothing spiritually in common. They don't have anything in common. They don't worship the same God. One believes, the other one doesn't believe. One goes to the temple and serves idols, the other one serves God. They don't have anything in common. And so God's saying, be careful about that. Be on guard with that. Now, because we are God's temple, God commands us to separate from unbelievers. He said, you're the temple of God. If you know the Lord is your Savior, you're the temple of God, you're to separate from the unbelievers. We're to be different from them. And since we have these promises, the word promises there in verse number 1 of 7 is actually a word that means announcements. We have these announcements, the things that he just told us here about separation and not being unequally yoked. He says, we have these promises, therefore we are to cleanse ourselves from all filthiness of the flesh and spirit, perfecting holiness and fear of God. You know, peer pressure among young people has always been strong. There was a lot of peer pressure when I was a kid. There was a lot of peer pressure when you were a kid. But you young people now, you face a peer pressure that was probably stronger than any of ours because of the advancement of technology. There is the social media, there is the mobile phones, there's the television and the internet, and all of these things have made peer pressure at an all-time high. There is a strong pressure on you to say you need to be like us. You've got to be like us. You've got to be with, pushing you toward being like everybody else. And God says, no, step back and say, you can't be like everybody else because you're my people. You've got to be different. Now, that doesn't mean that we need to be weird. It doesn't mean that we need to, you know, look strange. But we need to be separated from the ungodly parts of the world. And that takes courage and that takes prudence to be able to know what is right to do what to right. It's not easy to separate and live a godly life in our culture. It's not easy. And you young people, you're facing a tough one. It's not easy. And we cannot constantly mingle with and befriend and socialize with unbelievers without it influencing us. It's impossible. You can't be around them. You know, it's a reminder. When I used to be on the farm, you couldn't go to the barn and come back to the house without smelling like you've been to the barn. That's just the way it was. That was just part of it. Because the barn has a smell to it. And so it is in our world. You know, you cannot be around the world and think it's not going to influence me. It will. It will. And we need to be very careful to guard ourselves. Here's a few suggestions that will help us in this difficult task. Number one, spend quality time in the Bible and prayer every day. Gotta have it. Spend that quality time in the Bible. Because the Bible helps us to make the right choices. To know what is right and what is wrong. Number two, do not feed your soul with the world's music, godless TV, the videos, the rubbish internet, and the wicked talk of the world. Don't feed on that. Don't let that keep mulling over in your mind. You know, one of the saddest things is when people have to work in environments where the music is playing all day long and it's all the filthy rubbish music. That's tragic. I know my boys, when they were young, they used to work out at IGA in various places, and the music was terrible, and they'd come home and say, "Dad, it's so hard to keep that music out of your head." You're absolutely right. It's bad enough just going into Bunnings and listening to all the rubbish music that comes across the intercom and leaving there with a clean mind. But working with it constantly, it's hard. And my heart goes out to people like, how do you deal with that? You're going to have to saturate your soul with that which is good and godly and feed your soul on the Word of God. We need to seek God's wisdom in choosing our friends. Very critical. How do you choose your friends? Oh, I just like them. Oh, they're a nice person. Oh, we just get along. Oh, we kind of think alike. Oh, we're both in the same class. You know, no, listen, we've got to choose our friends very carefully. Not everybody that may click with you is a good friend. They may lead you astray. They may lead you the wrong direction. We need to be very careful in our choice of friends. Number four, we need to live our lives to the glory of God, including our thoughts and our words and our actions and our activities. Live for God's glory. Number five, be a testimony for the Lord. Do not live like a flytrap. What's a flytrap like? Well, the flytrap has an odor that attracts flies. And if you live like a flytrap works because the smell attracts the flies, and if your testimony smells like God, you will not attract the devil's flies. But if your testimony smells like the world, then you're going to attract the devil's flies. They're going to be swarming you because that's the way life is. One other thing I can say for each of us to ponder, and applies more perhaps to the young people and parents than it does to us old fogies, but young people, never choose a sweetheart until you are old enough to marry. You know, the philosophy of our world is, as soon as you're about 10 or 11 or 12, or maybe not even that old, oh, she's my girlfriend, he's my boyfriend, and all this kind of stuff. And I mean, I was caught up in that too, so I'm not talking ignorantly. Alright? I wasn't taught. But the best thing to do is to save all that until you're old enough to say, alright, I'm ready, I'm going to start looking for a wife, or I'm going to start looking for a husband. Then go looking. Why go looking earlier when you can't marry anyway? And that's why so many young people get themselves in big trouble. And having a sweetheart is not for recreation. It is not just so we can have a fun time together. It isn't, because a lot of the fun times they have together end up being bad fun times together. When you're old enough to marry and to look for a sweetheart, look first for their spiritual life, then at their character. What kind of a spiritual life do they have? And what kind of character do they have? When I talk about character, I'm talking about how do they act? How do they respond to authority? How do they react to the laws of the land? How do they obey their parents? Are they hardworking? Are they energetic? Or are they a lazy person that's always sitting around or playing on their phone and playing games and just lazy and doing nothing? What kind of character do they have? Because that is what you're going to live with for the rest of your life once you married that person. And sadly, many people marry for their looks and for their personality, and because they just appeal to them. And then after they get married, all that just gets old real fast. And then they're stuck with their character and they say, I can't even stand this person. And they didn't even know it. They didn't think. So that is so critical. You've got to think on those things because it's very important. Then as we go beyond that, character is far more important than good looks. Proverbs chapter 31 verse 30 tells us that the beauty is vain, but the fear of the Lord, that's what matters. And if they are not what they ought to be, then never think that you will change them. Never think that you're going to change them. It won't happen. Oh, there may be a miracle once in a while, but most of the time, it doesn't happen. It goes the other direction. And so many young people think, well, you know, she's not just what she ought to be, but I'll fix her. No, she'll fix you. And that's the way it always happens. The bad overrules. You know, it's just like, you know, the apples in a basket of apples. And you boys understand this. If you take one rotten apple and put it in a basket of apples, tomorrow all the apples are going to be beautiful, aren't they? No, what's going to happen the other way around, half of them are going to be rotten in a couple of days because they're sitting next to the rotten one and it's polluting them. And that's the same thing that happens, and that's why God said you've got to separate from the ungodly, because they're like the rotten apple and they will pollute you and they will contaminate you. Then the last thought along the same line is that most of all, never ever choose a sweetheart that is not a godly Christian. Never, 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 never. A lot of young people think, well, she's just my girlfriend. I'm not going to marry her. We're just having fun together. Don't do it, because so many young people say, oh, she's just my girlfriend. And then, oh, yeah, I kind of like my girlfriend. And, oh, we're in love now, Dad. And yeah, but she's not a Christian. But, yeah, but I really love her. And she loves me. And we want to get married. And then your emotions take over and you end yourself up in a trap that will destroy you. It'll ruin you. God says, don't do it. So Ezra here identifies the crime. But then notice briefly that Ezra made a confession to God. Ezra made his confession to God. He pours out his heart to God with a brokenness. We see there in verse number 3, and when I heard this thing, this is Ezra speaking, I rent my clothes, I tore my garments and my mantle, and I plucked off my hair and off my head and of my beard, and I sat down astonished. Here, you just picture it in your mind. He's tore his clothes. You know, in those days, their clothing weren't as quality as ours. And he tore his clothes, ripped holes in them, and he pulled out hair out of his beard. That would hurt. He pulled out his hair. It didn't mean that he pulled all his hair out of his head, but he jerked hair out of his head. That would hurt. Pulled it clear out. And he sat down. It said he sat down there astonished or just appalled or stunned or horrified at what was taking place. He said, I can't believe this is happening. This is drastically bad. And then he says there that in verse 4, then were assembled unto me everyone that trembled at the words of the God of Israel because of the transgression of of those that had been carried away. And I sat astonished until the evening sacrifice. So he says, others that trembled at this, others that said, this is bad, this is bad. They came and joined him. They sat down with him and they all sat there praying and pouring out their hearts to God and weeping over these things. We see this down in verse number 6. That instead, oh my God, I am ashamed and blush to lift up my face unto thee, my God, for our iniquities are increased over our heads, and our trespasses gone up unto heavens. He says, we have sinned, God. I am so ashamed that I am part of these people that have done this, God. I am so ashamed. And he was burdened and grieved. And so he pours out his shame and his confession to God. And he acknowledges the problem. We saw that in verse 7. And he credited God with the grace of helping them. Verse number 8. And now, for a little space, grace has been given. Or grace has been showed from the Lord our God to leave us a remnant to escape and to give us a nail in the holy place, that our God may lighten our eyes and give us a little reviving of our bondage. All right, so he said, we've been in bondage, but now, God, you've been so good to us. You gave us a little bit of a break. You've allowed us to come back. You've set us free. You've enabled us to be able to come back here. And now, what has happened? And then he goes on in verse number 9. It says, for we were bondmen, yet our God hath not forsaken us in our bondage, but hath extended his mercy on us in the sight of our kings of Persia, to give us a reviving, to set up the house of our God, and to repair the desolations thereof, and to give us a wall in Judah and Jerusalem. And now, O our God, what shall we say after this? For we have forsaken the commandments. And then he goes on, we read those commandments that he gave us earlier. He says, we've forsaken them. And verse 13, he says, after all that is come upon us, for our evil deeds, you know, that 70 years in Babylon, all that came upon us for our evil deeds, and for our great trespass, seeing that thou, our God, hast punished us less than our iniquities deserve, and hath given us such deliverance as this, should we again break the commandments and join affinity with the people of these abominations? Wouldst not thou be angry with us till thou hast consumed us, so that there should be no remnant nor escape? What he's saying here is, God, after all that we've done wrong, and you've punished us, and now we come back, you've set us free, you've been good to us, and got us back, and we turn right around and do it again. God, you have every right to wipe us off the map. You have the right to destroy us for this. And he was greatly burdened, greatly burdened. And he concludes it in verse 15, The Lord God of Israel, thou art righteous, for we remain yet escaped as it is this day. Behold, we are before thee in our trespass, for we cannot stand before thee because of this. He says, we have committed great sin against you. So, as we tie this all together, Ezra identified the crime. The crime was they were intermingling and intermarrying with the unbelievers. And he made his confession to God. And he poured out his heart to God and said, God, we are very wrong. And he could see that there was a big trouble. They were headed for major problems. You know, God's lesson for us today, as parents, we need to teach our children, train them, discipline them, guide them in the right direction, and encourage them to wait until they're ready for marriage to find a sweetheart, and then to keep themselves pure and to find spouses that are faithful, godly Christians. And for you young people, the same applies to you. God's message for you is to cooperate with your parents, to wait until you're ready for marriage to find a sweetheart. Never give your heart to an unbelieving sweetheart. Keep yourself pure until marriage. Begin now to pray daily. Young people, listen. Begin now. You may say, oh, I'm only young. I got a long time. Begin now to pray for a spouse, that God would save you that one that He's chosen for you. And then be faithful to God and wait for His timing for that godly spouse that He's prepared for you. It's critical. It's critical. And remember how I began the message tonight. If you look at me and say, Pastor, you're old-fashioned and crazy, then you go find some folks that are married to unbelievers. And if you can't think of any, come see me. I'll give you some examples to find. And you go talk to them and ask them, is it okay to marry an unbeliever? And they're going to tell you, don't. You'll ruin your life. It'll hurt. It's hard. It's painful. It's not good. Don't do it. Because they've been through it and they're in it. It's not easy. And so we need to guard ourselves and protect ourselves. And now's the time to do it.